Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. My name is Katerina Stoikova. I'm the creator and the host of this podcast, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. Today's brilliant guest is B. Elizabeth Beck. She and I go way back. We've been friends for quite some time. And this is not our first on-record conversation and likely not the last. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Accents.
Hello, Katerina. Thank you so much for affording this time with me this afternoon. Happy June.
Happy June, one of my favorite months.
Yes, wonderful season.
Your first short story collection came out several months ago, Swan Songs. I remember reading it in manuscript form and writing to you after that, asking, teach me how to do that.
Thank you.
And you said, it's easy. Just pick a theme. Tell us the theme of Swan Songs.
Absolutely. The theme of Swan Songs is music. So each story has a framing structure of a different musical artist. For example, when including Dolly Parton, Rolling Stones, Tina Turner, Grateful Dead. Now, none of the stories are about those artists, but the stories themselves are framed by that particular genre or that particular art musical artist. And I wrote a baker's dozen stories about women and their relationships to themselves and to others, and how music plays a role in each one of their lives. And I think that having a framing structure, having a theme, helps guide you in prose, much like when you choose a form in poetry. So if you decide to write a collection of haiku, you are following a specific format, meter, the three lines, the 5-7-5. If you're writing a sonnet, you're following a format. I find that in prose, having some type of format, a framing structure, if you will, helped to guide my stories. And then I was able to make careful decisions while I was writing. Have I included a woman in her late 70s, early 80s? Have I included a woman who is a mother who's frustrated with the suburban shuffle, who has kids? Have I included a couple who don't have children, things like that, so that I could look at different perspectives and kind of have the goal of being a little inclusive with the writings, even though this particular book is about women. It's not for women, though.
The table of contents reads like almost like a mixtape or a playlist. What do you
I
think?
love that. That's lovely. Thank you very much. I really had a good time, picking the titles. I'm trying to pull out the table of contents myself, to look at it. And some of them are absolute direct references to the music. See here how everything is a famous snatch of a phrase from a Grateful Dead song, and that would be a clue to the reader what you're getting into. Mother's Little Helper is a famous Rolling Stone song. And so they should operate themselves as almost a poem, as a playlist, if you will, and as indicators to the reader of what kind of a story they're getting into. And I had opportunity in this collection to delve a little bit into speculative fiction, which is a lot of fun for me. I enjoy the dreaming aspect, and I've had a story in my mind for a very long time about a woman who gets confused with her waking consciousness and her dream life. And I got to kind of explore that in Mother's Little Helper, where her dream almost becomes her reality, and then she wakes up to her reality, but she's remembering her dream, and it goes back and forth. So it was a way for me to explore that avenue of writing, and storytelling. And then the other story that is speculative in nature is a story that was inspired by real life. A woman I know whose mother had eight children, who I just find to be a remarkable human being. And I've always kind of wanted to catch the essence of their family. And it ends up being a speculative piece of fiction about her maybe passing over into the next life. I leave it a little open for interpretation for that way. But it was fun, and I hope that it definitely leaps from the page with joy and the fun I had in writing it.
You've arranged many poetry collection. How is arranging a short story collection different? Is it harder? Is it easier?
I think they both have their challenges. I think that I'm more well-versed in arranging a poetry collection, so I have the experience and knowledge of how to have the poems speak to each other. And this was more something new. I actually kept a whole list. I had two lists going ahead. The first was the brainstorm list of all the stories I wanted to cover and all the artists I'd like to use for the framing. And then as I went through it, I kept a list of what I had actually written. And then it was a matter of shuffling those stories so that they did speak to each other and they didn't feel jarring, and you had a sense of movement from one story to the other.
So the music came first, the characters.
I'm not sure if the music came first or if the stories and yeah no I think the music came first, and I did a deep research. For example, I don't listen to country music. I don't know Dolly Parton, so to delve into learning so much about her sparked so much for me, to the point where I'm actually taking a workshop in a couple weeks. A gentleman at the Carnegie Center is going to present a poetry workshop based on Dolly Parton. And I'm taking the workshop because of how much I learned and how much I admire her as a human and The Coat of Many Colors. I mean, that song still stays with me. All these years after I've written the manuscript. So, I do have to admit though, I burned out a little bit on music after, because what I would do is I would queue up almost the entire catalogs as much as I could of Dolly Parton or of the Rolling Stones or of Tina Turner and do these deep dives and, spend days and days and days while I'm also a painter, a visual artist. So while I'm painting, I'm listening to the music, thinking of the stories in my head. And when we released the book, I actually had been working in silence for the first time. And then fortunately, last week I had opportunity to go on a family vacation. And my adult son was the DJ for the week, and he flooded me with all new music I had never heard before. And it was such a treat to be ignited and reconnected to music in a way where I had taken a step back, kind of from listening, and it's interesting because his whole life from when he was in the womb on, I always streamed music from the minute I woke up till the minute I went to bed. There was always music running in the house. And I mean, obviously I still go to concerts. I still go to shows. I work out every day to my beloved Phish, at the gym. But in terms of, having that music in the background of my life, it abruptly ended in July. And I needed to take a step back and sit in silence for a bit and allow new ideas to bubble up.
Well, silence is part of music, but I want to ask you, what can a song reveal about a character that ordinary exposition cannot?
I think that definitely the key and tone that the music is played to would be able to evoke a mindset for what the character or what the story is about. And I love jazz. I listen to a lot of, I always have listened to a lot of jazz. And it's interesting to hear how people have interpreted my poems with kind of that staccato beat and rhythm because I've been influenced so much by jazz.
I would love to hear an excerpt. Read us as little or as much as you would like.
That would be great. I would like to read an excerpt from a story called About to Run, which is a song that Trey Anastasio plays with Phish, but he also plays with his jazz band, the Trey Anastasio Band. And this story is not about me, but was inspired by my experience of going to Phoenix, Arizona to see the Trey Anastasio Band. And well, I just want to go ahead and read this excerpt about what music means to me. Second set soothes Tony with one of her favorite songs, Drifting, and she is delighted to hear Curlew's Call. This older song floats her back to their early days of marriage, cooking spaghetti in the kitchen, drinking red wine out of mason jars, and dancing barefoot. Tony's revelry is jolted when Trey wails about to run. She watches Willow dance, tears streaming down her face. Sand is a redemption, but to end the encore with life beyond a dream is healing. Tony wraps her arms around Willow's waist as they sway and sing along with the band, and everyone connects in the audience under this magical spell. And I wanted to read that passage because there is a certain magical healing component that I have found to connecting with live music. And I really wanted to kind of showcase that within that particular story. But cooking has been a huge part of all of my writing in stories and in poetry. And, I found a passage from Backward Down the Number Line, which is an excerpt from a novel I've been working on for several years, and it operates as a short story. And this spring, I had the pleasure of offering a culinary writing workshop at the Carnegie, and it inspired me to start writing an entire collection of new stories, and this one framed by different culinary aspects. And I'm finding as I'm going back and looking at my collections of poetry and my stories and my novels, how much cooking has played a huge part in my stories. So this is from Backward Down the Number Line. Lucy cracks two eggs and separates the yolks, discarding the whites before cracking a third egg and whisking it into a foam. She fills a pot with water to boil linguine before dicing onions and garlic to saute in olive oil in a skillet. The red pepper she roasted earlier, its black skin shed, seeds and stems removed, lay on a wood cutting board to be sliced to add to the carbonara. A small dish of verdant green peas Lucy purchased at the farmer's market lay ready. Oregano, never basil. Cracked black pepper, freshly grated Parmesan cheese, and so much salt it makes the water taste like the ocean are the last ingredients to make Lucy's famous carbonara for dinner. Instead of pancetta, Lucy likes to use thick-cut hardwood bacon she bakes on a stone pan until it crumbles at the touch, a trick she adopted when her daughter had her wisdom teeth removed and couldn't eat the too gummy pancetta, but was pleading for her favorite dinner.
Reading these stories, I am aware of the rhythm, but hearing you read them out loud, I can really hear the poet who wrote the short stories.
Thank you. That's the biggest compliment I could possibly receive. I say I'm a poet who writes fiction, and I was once questioned at a reading about like, what does that mean? I personally feel that I am a more accomplished, better prose writer because of how intently I've studied poetry. And I think when you take the time to hone your craft in verse, then it's going to lean towards how you construct your language in prose and creative nonfiction as well. But I'm infamous for dropping all of the articles in my prose, and having to go back and saying, a the might be a good idea here, Elizabeth, or a or an might serve better, whereas in poetry. But I do also like the new trend in prose of writing in present tense, and of course we do that in poetry,
Right.
but historically, and I'm a huge fiction reader. I mean, I still am a library girl and I still read fiction prolifically. And the fiction in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up was all in past tense. And it was an interesting switch when I first started reading, contemporary prose of this era, that it's in present tense. And I've enjoyed adopting that practice within the manuscripts.
Prose fiction is anchored in the details, and many of these stories are filled with very specific details: food, clothing, music, architecture, gardens, neighborhoods. How do you know when you've found the details that unlock a character?
I think that I like to find the magic in the ordinary. And I write what I know and what I'm comfortable with and what I've studied in my own personal life and as an academic. And consequently, even if it's speculative, it's still set in a particular ordinary circumstance, where the character is, driving to work or talking to her colleague over coffee or any of the ordinary things that we do, which anchors the setting and drives the plot of the story. I am still working on ekphrastic poetry and in searching for the cover for Swan Songs, unearthed an entire research wormhole. We use the cover, which is a painting by Hilma af Klint. And I watched a documentary and about her, and in it, there was the screen showed all of these unsung women artists who never got acknowledged during their own time period. And we're seeing a huge resurgence now of unearthing their works. And actually, there's a huge retrospective going on for Hilma af Klint right now in Paris. I keep telling Kevin, we need to go. We need to go to Europe to see this. I actually screenshotted a picture of a woman taking a picture of our cover, of Swan Song's cover, but the actual painting. And so I would like to share two poems about this new collection that I'm working on. The first one is An Actual Intention. And so that's what the title is. What I seek in these poems is not their technique. I do not seek the art they create nor the awards they won. What I seek in these poems are the little details that give them life. I want to know them as people who loved, want to know what tragedies they survived, wish to learn what they ate for breakfast, how they endured life, push to continue creating. Dare say, even seek inspiration, looking for clues, a guidepost, a map. So maybe I'll keep painting too. And then I'll read the poem I wrote about Hilma af Klint. And this manuscript is moving very, very slowly, as did Painted Daydreams, for the same reason. I spent days, not just hours, days immersed in researching one artist. To write one poem takes days and days and days of research, and I love it. I'm a teacher, so this is my heart's delight. And what I try to do is just grab that one little interesting detail to flesh out into a poem, more so than making a commentary about the art that they created. I truly am interested in them as people. So Hilma af Klint, if I could join the five. Circle of mystic women holding seances, seeking inspiration for compositions, I'm still not sure I would see natural elements the way you deconstructed atoms, studying organic growth through spiritual lens, creating paintings so large it steals breath, as I wonder why you specified your work to be kept secret for 20 years after your death. More than 1,200 pieces and even more sketchbooks beyond the visible now celebrated the way you deserve. Did the spirits direct your decision?
I love how much I learn from your poetry and how I benefit from your method writing. You know, get it? Like method acting, method writing. That's what you do.
I love that. I definitely have conversations with the artists. I just taught a wonderful ekphrastic workshop in the Nelson County Public Library in Bardstown. And that's one of the things I teach in the ekphrastic workshop is have a conversation with the artist. You know, your goal in ekphrastic painting, or in writing in any kind is not to explain it. Because the relationship of the viewer to the art is going to be different for everyone. I would instead be more interested in reading a poem about your questions about the artist or why Miro had to eat radishes one entire winter of his life, or the fact that Kandinsky couldn't figure out what was going on with his painting, and so he went out to take a walk. And while he was there, the maid was cleaning up and she knocked the painting over and put it back up the wrong way. And he walked in and thought, ah, that's it. That's the painting. Now, those are the kind of magical details that inspire me. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in writing. And I think I found that from teaching arts and humanities to a bunch of reluctant high school kids for years and years, that if I could find the strangest little details to capture their attention, then we could get into the actual academia of analyzing their compositions.
Several stories contain women who are carrying secret lives or hidden longings. Were you interested in the gap between how women appear to the world and what is actually happening inside them?
An interesting insight. And it's something that I feel I struggle or work on myself. I am much more introverted than I appear. I know that when I host Poetry at the Table month after month, I put on a costume of sorts. It's authentic, it's real. My responses to the poets is absolutely from the heart. But the, get up with all that energy and get on the mic. I mean, that's what I used to do as Ms. Beck in the classroom. And I found a lot of relief, as a younger woman, particularly. I would say we would leave our proverbial suitcase of trauma and issues or daily life or anything at the door, put on your glasses and don this role of teacher, Ms. Beck. And it was wonderful because then you could be consumed in the moment and what you were doing and, allow the rest of it to dissipate for that short period of time. Now that I'm retired from teaching and I'm writing full time and running my community service project, I do feel there is a little bit more of an integration. But I do think that there are misperceptions that I think all people have about each other when we make assumptions. And I think that if we take the time to actually sit down and have a cup of coffee with someone and talk to them directly, we would gather a lot more information about what really inspires them or what they're truly passionate about or what upsets them or where their feelings get hurt or any of those kind of things. There's the external and then there's the internal. And I try to behave authentically and true to myself with the loving kindness that I feel, even in a world gone mad, which is where I feel that we are in right now. And it takes a lot, it's also a lot of it has to deal with the stupid social media stuff. There's beauty to the fact that we're connected with it. Gosh, it was so much fun when it first started, connecting with your old sixth grade boyfriend, or seeing your old neighbor, or just things like that. That was lovely. Now not so much, and you really need to be careful about it, I think. And so there's a level of protectiveness that I think I have more now. Maybe that's just age. That might be age.
I mean, to me, it feels like I cannot really get off social media because of the cost of not being in it. We have invested so much.
You're right. I know a local musician who went off social media and came back and said, "I'm tired of playing to an empty room." So I'm back on. It's a necessary vehicle that people, especially independent artists, smaller artists, are using in order to promote their next show, their exhibit, book release, those kind of things. And people use it. I mean, I know that the younger generation doesn't like Facebook and they stay on Instagram, but the events on Facebook don't exist on Instagram. And I think a lot of people rely upon those calendars for what's going on in their own local community or what's going on in whatever other communities. For example, with my fish community, when Fish goes on summer tour, then my feed is going to dramatically shift to everybody's pictures and moments and complaints and excitement about the band being on tour for a month. And then that dies down, and the algorithm is interesting. Can we purposely break the algorithm? Would we want to? I happen to be very grateful that my feed is full of artists and writers and musicians, because at least then I know where to tread and where I can tread softly. So that's kind of a nice thing. And I want to see if somebody gets a book, or what the list of Accents Publishing, coming out, or who won what prize. I like to know that stuff. I like to see Ada Limón with her sweet garden things, and I like to know all that stuff. Oh, Amy Tan and her bird watching, and that kind of stuff is fantastic, right? That availability of information about quote unquote celebrities, or people who are well known, that's kind of a cool thing. But it can, I have to be very careful about the time I spend with it. So I've kind of gotten in a routine and a situation where I don't reach to pick up the phone very often. In fact, the phone generally sits on the kitchen counter, and I can be up here in the studio for hours and not even realize, whatever. I do. It does concern me when I see, we were at the beach for a week, and fortunately, neither my husband nor my son are very engaged with their phones. But it was amazing when we went out and about to restaurants and boat excursions, and you'd see all the families, and every one of their heads were in these, tiny little screens, all the time. They weren't looking at each other. They weren't talking to each other. So, I mean, that's stuff that people talk about all the time, though. So,
I would love to hear more writing by you, whether it's from the Swan Songs book or poems or new work or whatever you want to share.
wonderful. I will read a story called Take Five from Swan Songs. Paige cues up Dave Brubeck's quartet and inserts the tiny white buds into her ears to launch her daily walk. The only good thing to come out of this era is the ability to stream music. Now Paige can actually hear the soundtrack of her life and not just through memory. The music inspires her to follow her cardiologist's dire warnings. Anything to stay out of the doctor's office, and if a daily walk does the trick, Paige asked her favorite grandson to help her curate different playlists so she would have no excuse not to do her cardio or whatever nonsense her daughter calls it. Paige calls it a walk. All New Yorkers walk. Paige doesn't know exactly when in childhood this habit of mentally streaming music started. She only knows there is a song for every moment of her waking life, and sometimes in her dreams too. You would assume Paige is a musician. She loves music so passionately, but alas, after months of tedious piano lessons, it was quite apparent that 6-year-old Paige lacked that certain something musicians must possess to play the most rudimentary melodies, and she did it badly. It made no difference to Paige, who would rather listen to music than make it. Even though learning to play clarinet in what is now called middle school was a heady experience once the band accomplished playing an entire song. She doesn't regret abandoning the woodwind in high school in lieu of pursuing a romance with Joe. He proved to be a good husband and a wonderful father, not to mention the perfect lover. Not that Paige would have anyone else to compare to Joe. When they married in 1965, it wasn't unusual for a woman to be a virgin. Paige surrendered to Joe when they became engaged, grateful for the birth control pill, regardless of the Supreme Court's recent decision, Griswold versus Connecticut. Nobody paid any attention to it anyway, and Paige was lucky. No unwanted pregnancies for her, no scandals, nothing but the soundtrack of her life she cues up mentally. Until now. Now she has the real thing. Any song, anytime, anywhere Paige happens to be. And that story, although I'm not a 75, 80-year-old woman yet, again, is really inspired by my own life. I have a song running in my head all the time. It's not intentional. Sometimes it does drive me a little crazy, and I have to really work at meditating to get rid of that song. And it's funny because my husband was cutting the grass yesterday and listening to music on his big headset. And he said when he was trying to go to bed last night, he had this song running in his head and he couldn't get rid of it. And he really struggled going to sleep. And I tilted my head and I was like, "You don't have a song running in your head at all times, like all day, every day." And he was like, "You're that's a very sad state of being, I guess, in a way." But I guess I'm kind of used to it in my brain. At the same time, I have a song going. I am thinking about the novel that I'm reading. I'm thinking about the food that I'm cooking. And I'm thinking about the poems I'm composing. And I seem to have those tracks running in my brain. So meditating has really been very helpful to me.
What song would be the title of the story you're currently living?
Great question. This must be the place by the Talking Heads. It goes home, it's where I want to be. Lift me up and turn me round. And I'm really centered here in my home on the pond. I'm in a deep space of focusing on the present. I'm not interested as much in the past. I spent a lot of time pooling memories and using them and writing poetry about my past. I was very future forward thinking when I was younger, very ambitious, and had very clear dreams of what I wanted for my future. And right now I'm in this lovely, very quiet space where I'm focusing on my gratitudes and the quiet and peacefulness of my life right now. It's never been so quiet. And I find it to be a very fertile space for creativity. I'm painting at a level that I haven't painted since art school, and that feels really good. I'm in a generative space. I went to visit an old college friend this weekend, and it felt wonderful driving the 2 hours to her home, thinking I have a collection of short stories in progress. I have a poetry manuscript in progress, and I have a series of paintings in progress. And that's the sweet spot. I think, of being an artist is that generative in progress where you're not facing the blank page or the blank canvas. You know where you are.
And in this quiet creative space, if you could be having dinner with three musicians represented in swan songs, who would you invite and why?
Well, first and foremost would be Trey Anastasio, the lead guitarist of Phish. I love him. I'm madly in love with him, not in a romantic way, in an intellectual way. I would love to sit down and talk to Trey. Right now, he's doing an acoustic tour, which is fantastic because it's a storytelling show. And the band is notorious for not talking on stage. So when Phish, the band, plays, they don't talk, they just play. But when Trey does this acoustic stuff, this is where he gets to tell stories and jokes and share things about his wife, Sue, and his children. We get more of a glimpse into his life. So I would absolutely like to talk to Trey. I would love to have met Dolly Parton. To meet her would be an honor and a privilege. I'm so in awe of what she's accomplished and done with her life and the philanthropy and the social consciousness in which that she operates her business is extraordinary. And then, of course, if we can pick anybody in alive or dead, Jerry Garcia, who is not with us anymore, that would have been fantastic to have even just, been able to shake his hand. Because he was kind of I don't want to say a father figure, but definitely a paternal figure in my life when I was a young woman, first on the Grateful Dead scene, coming out of a house of trauma and landing in such a safe space. And his voice, I can hear two notes of it and recognize it anywhere.
And I have one last question for you, Elizabeth. And it's a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing. What is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
To make a commitment to being a lifelong learner and being receptive and open to always learning. I'm the first in the classroom as a teacher to say, I don't know. Let's look it up together. I'm not quite sure. That's something great. Let me research it and I'll get back to you on it. And I think as long as you have a curiosity for life, I learned something really cool from a novel. The novel wasn't so great, but the lesson I learned was this, and I think it's really cool. I've been meditating on it. You really only need three things in life. One, a sense of purpose to your day. Two, something to anticipate in your life. And three, someone to share that with. And I thought, wow. When you break it down to the bare bones, isn't that, extraordinary? And for someone who struggles with depression and anxiety, that if I really just approach my day with, do I have a sense of purpose today? Do I have something really cool to look forward to in the near future? And do I have a great friend or a husband or someone I can talk to and share that experience with? That's about what it's all about, I think.
What a wonderful framework, what a wonderful message, what a wonderful book, Swan Songs. Thank
Thank
you
you.
so much, Elizabeth, and all the best with the new writing.
Thank you very much for this time. I appreciate it, Katerina.